The day following our election day, the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, gave his first State of the Nation address since he took office in May. With me now for today's Underreported, for a look at the pace of reform in Russia and Moscow's current attitudes toward the West, is Nina Khrushcheva. She teaches international affairs at the New School, and as you may have suspected from hearing her name, she's also the granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev. Her article in the fall 2008 World Policy Journal is called Russia's Rotting Empire. She is also the author of Imagining Nabokov, which was published earlier this year by Yale University Press. I'm pleased to welcome you to the show.
And thank you.
You didn't pull any punches with that title.
Yes, well, it's, that's what I was trying to convey, that Russian Empire has outlived its life.
You begin your article in the World Policy Journal with the statement that Russia doesn't change. What does that mean? Haven't things changed an awful lot since the fall of communism?
They have, and they haven't in many ways. What I'm trying to argue is that the system of governance in Russia almost always remained the same. It's a despotic system of governance. It's the state really tries to instill its own will over the will of the people all the time. And, you know, there is a very well-known formula that weak states have weak liberties. And it is very interesting that even at the times when Russia tries to open up and get less weak, it very fast in 10 years, 6 years, 8 years or so turned back into weak states and a strong weak liberties and strong state, and something that Vladimir Putin, when he took office in 2000, has shown, because he really kind of verticalized the state.
So this is something that goes back to the Tsars?
It goes back to right from the yes.
Is it because Russia's so big?
I think it's a huge handicap for Russia. 11 time zones is really sort of a it's no longer an advantage, and I think in the modern world it's a huge handicap, because you can imagine it's the country where in one part of it people wake up and the other part they only go to bed. I mean, how do you actually make a coherent system of governance where people don't even live in the same time zones?
But China seems to have worked it out better. Do you think it's also because Russia is a European state that is kind of out of the loop?
Yes, it's actually very well put, because one of my arguments is that Russia is actually a Western country that doesn't want to be one. It's afraid to be one. It's afraid of a competition. And so it takes this stand, oh, we are so much better. We have this unique soul and nobody can dictate us what to do. But unlike China, Russia doesn't have a set of values that is its own set of values. It's what the West is not.
But there is another side to it, as I see it. You have extreme absolutism with Stalin, followed by a modified absolutism with Khrushchev. And then you have more absolutism with Brezhnev, followed by less with Gorbachev.
Absolutely. And that's what I usually call sort of remission, this pendulum swing between remission and oppression. And it is indeed true. I mean, you have the absolute oppression and then a period of reform. But in a sense, I think with a pendulum, it actually doesn't move forward. It keeps recycling the same paradigm of development.
And so what have we seen since Gorbachev to Yeltsin to Putin?
It is very interesting question, because Yeltsin is supposed to be an autocrat, according to that pendulum, but they're on a cusp, because Gorbachev was still a Soviet leader and Yeltsin was already post-Soviet leader. So in some ways, they're both, in various different ways, they're both reformers. But it seems to me that when Yeltsin was replaced by Vladimir Putin, it's the same sort of, again, remission oppression. And so, according to my theory, Medvedev, if he gets rid of Putin's watchful eye, KGB eye, would probably should become a reformer in a vein of Nikita Khrushchev or Mikhail Gorbachev.
Well, can you tell us a bit about the relationship between Vladimir Putin, now that he's prime minister, and President Dmitry Medvedev?
Well, so far it looks like Dmitry Medvedev was installed by Putin, basically. I mean,
so
they
does
did
he have
run
any real power?
I think it seems like he's acquiring power, I think the situation has been changing. As you know, I'm sure your listeners know, there was this very short-lived war between Russia and Georgia in August, and it does seem that after that, given the financial crisis, the oil prices go down, it does seem that there are some tensions between the Kremlin and the White House, and the White House is where Vladimir Putin sits. It's the parliament seat. But I will be able to say more. I'm going to Moscow at the end of November. So far, I think the tensions are there. But on the surface, Medvedev is a very obedient Putin's flunky. But quite frankly, I just don't believe it.
So you think that as he gains more power, we're likely to see some kind of a power struggle?
I think we're already seeing a little bit of a power struggle. I don't want to bore your listeners and you with all the names and little details, but it's already, I mean, Medvedev already is trying to have his own team, and I think unlike Khrushchev or Gorbachev, for that matter, it's hard for him because Stalin was dead when Khrushchev came in, and Brezhnev was dead.
Well, he had a little power struggle for a little while.
Well, he had exactly. He did have a little power struggle. Who would be more democratic than the other? But nonetheless, the watchful eye of a dictator wasn't there, and I think Medvedev really faces a problem. On the other hand, Putin may win this fight, and you know Russia will build new gulags and say, well, the world is in crisis. We don't need to be part of the world. We're just going to be, you know, we build whatever Byzantium, that's what Putin's big thing, in one separately taken country.
Well, what does the Russian public think about all of this? Don't they just assume that Putin is still in charge no matter who is the president right now?
Yeah, they do. They do assume that he's still in charge. But the interesting thing, I mean, Russians love those who exude strong power. And Kremlin also very symbolic of power. So all the Putin is very, very popular. Dmitry Medvedev is also popular because he's seen as a right hand of the powerful guy. So in a sense, both of them are sort of somewhere around 78-80% of popularity. But I still think that Putin takes over in the Russian minds because he's much more dictatorial behaviorally than Medvedev is.
My guest is Nina Khrushcheva, who teaches international affairs at the New School. Her article in the fall 2008 World Policy Journal is called Russia's Rotting Empire. She's also, as I said earlier, the author of Imagining Nabokov, which was published earlier this year by Yale University Press. We'll talk about that a little later. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned the invasion of Georgia, which is still, right now, is still being debated over who really precipitated it. But what does that invasion last August tell us about the direction Russia may take in the future? Do you see this as any way similar to Russia and Chechnya, or is this a totally different kind of a thing?
I think in a sense, I mean, as we started this conversation, we agreed that Russia doesn't change. So in some ways, there are similarities. The difference is that Chechnya is indeed part of Russia, Russian Federation, and Georgia is a separate own country, although used to be part of the Soviet Union. It still hasn't been decided who invaded whom and first. I actually, unlike many analysts, I don't see that Russia now is going to go and invade Poland and invade Ukraine and invade all these other countries. I think Georgia is a particular separate special case. And I think it was Putin indeed was flexing his muscle. And, you know, that's yet another part of Russia doesn't change. It's a typical behavior is to show only by force that we're strong. But also, I think it was more a message is to say, I don't believe Saakashvili is a Democrat. And as long as you're going to push him as a Democrat, we're really going to debate that because don't give us him as an example of a great democratic power.
Wasn't he also sending a message to the United States?
I think it was a message to the United States. It wasn't too much. I mean, it was a little bit of Saakashvili because Putin is a good despot. He really doesn't like people criticizing him and criticizing him publicly. And it's not even a rumor. It is known that that Saakashvili one time called Putin a Lily Putin, and Putin really doesn't take these jokes, this kind of jokes lightly. He's slightly a revengeful guy. But it's certainly a message to the United States is that this is a wrong Democrat you are supporting, and don't give it to him. Give him to me as an example of democracy.
Would it also be a message to some of the other former Soviet states that he would like to keep in line?
I think it would be more of a message to say we can do it. I don't think it was, as I said, unlike many analysts, I don't think it's the promise that they can do it. But it was a message is that we can do it. Don't mess with us.
Well, since Stalin came from Georgia, is that something that still is a thing that Putin might be aware of when he's thinking about Georgia? Or is Stalin totally out of the story these days?
Oh, no. Stalin is a big story these days. I mean, Russia is a very Stalinist state today because Stalin is being lauded as one of the greatest leaders of the past and the most important leader of the 20th century. In fact, there was a Russian project organized by the state TV and the Kremlin on the name of Russia. And Stalin, for a very long time, was either number one or number two in the name of Russia. And then they supposedly adjusted the tally, and Stalin became the 12th, because I think it would be a huge embarrassment for the nation to say, oh, my God, Russia still in 2008 believes that Stalin was a name in Russia. Imagine that about Hitler or Franco or somebody. So Stalin is big, but I think Stalin is such a grand dictator that there is an understanding that he's Georgian, but he's above nations. And I think Stalin himself really portrayed himself as more Russian than anything else.
And are the 20 million people or so who were his victims, the Russians I'm talking about alone,
absolutely.
Are they totally forgotten?
Well, they're not forgotten. I mean, Putin did visit a site of there was a museum built, burial, and Putin did visit that site and said it's very unfortunate. But on the other hand, in 2007, the new book for teachers were published on history, and there it was explained as he had no other choice. He needed to create a managerial class. He needed to overcome the West, and therefore he had to kill his own people.
Putin has called himself a modernizer. Do you agree with him?
In a Russian sense, which is, you know, slightly mutated, but a lot of Russian dictators call themselves modernizers. I mean, Stalin thought he was a great modernizer because in 20 years he turned, as it was explained, a peasant country into industrial state. My problem with this kind of modernization is that because it's built basically on people's bones, on people's freedoms, is that very fast and it's very tactical. It's only about today. It's not looking into the future. That's actually the comparison to China, interesting, because they are looking into the future, is that it becomes obsolete very fast. I mean, Stalin industrialization became obsolete in 30 years. Who cares about it today?
Well, you say that Putin is really acting as a direct descendant of the Byzantine kings, and an important Byzantine symbol was the double-headed eagle. That's Russia's new state symbol.
Yes, it is, and they're very proud of it. And that's another 11 time zones is a Russian handicap. Two double-headed eagle is a handicap because, like the pendulum swinging back and forth, looking east and west, it's very hard to move forward when you don't know where you're exactly looking.
Joseph Conrad wrote a novel before the Soviet Revolution about Russia, and it was called Under Western Eyes, and the sense was that they were always living with an awareness of how they were being judged by the West.
Right. It's. I think one of the problems is, and I think in many ways Putin's reaction to the West, so zero sum, if you're going to do this, I'm going to do this, is exactly that. I mean, Russia does have a huge inferiority complex, something that I said it's a Western country that is afraid to become one precisely because it feels slightly inferior and doesn't want to compete on regular terms, so it invents its own terms.
Did it feel inferior even at the time when it was seen as the most powerful nation other than the United States?
You mean during the Cold War?
Yeah, when Ronald Reagan was calling it the evil empire.
It was inferior. I mean,
were at least the people in the Soviet states, did they understand that this was really a Potemkin village?
I think in some ways they did. I mean, the dissident movement started in the 60s and went on. When Khrushchev went to the United States in 59, I think it contributed greatly because he was a softer despot, softer autocrat. He brought a washing machine to the Soviet Union, and in many ways, to paraphrase Richard Nixon, I think that broke back of that son of a bitch, because you introduced a foreign body into the military-industrial complex, and people were aware of them. I mean, they may be great, and, you know, they were building great tanks, and everybody was afraid of them, and Sputnik went up. And I don't want to diminish this, these achievements, but the problem is people did know that we have no washing machines. There's no quality of life, so to speak. In some ways, it was inferiority, because you build Sputniks, but you actually live in a communal apartment and you have to stand in line for bread. That really contributes to your great, this combination of inferiority and superiority complex, which is very damaging.
And they were aware that in other countries that didn't happen?
Oh, of course. I mean, I remember people were going to Hungary and were buying things that were completely not available in the Soviet Union. Even Cuba was a paradise because you could get things of the sort of the soft power things that the Soviet Union didn't have.
So it wasn't capitalism that was the problem. It was just the Soviet Union that was the problem.
In a sense. I mean, capitalism was a problem, but the joke was, why do they live so well if it's a rotting system? And, you know, Marx promised us that they're going to go down, but it seems like we are going down rather than them.
Nina Khrushcheva has written an article for the World Policy Journal called Russia's Rotting Empire. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Nina Khrushcheva, who teaches international affairs at the New School and has written an article in the fall 2008 World Policy Journal called Russia's Rotting Empire. There's been an economic boom in Russia in recent years, built largely on rising oil prices. What's going to happen now that the prices have really fallen considerably?
Once again, going back to our original statement that Russia doesn't change, I mean, it happened before, it's happening again. Russia builds its strength on oil and gas, and then the world prices go down, and Russia basically goes down with it, because Russian leaders really not strategic thinkers. They don't invest into infrastructure. Putin, like his predecessors, did very little in that regard. So my expectation, and that another part of our conversation that we had, is that if Medvedev is indeed interested to be more in vein of Khrushchev and Gorbachev than Stalin, Brezhnev, and Putin, then it would be his opportunity and his chance.
When Garry Kasparov was here, he described Putin and the people around him as a kleptocracy. He said, as long as oil prices are high, they're just going to want to stay in power because they're skimming so much off the top.
Absolutely. And also they can give a little bit away that's how they can justify their great success and power.
So does this suggest that Putinism is just a temporary thing? Or can we see it as being similar to Peronism that continues to survive even though Juan Perón has been dead for many years?
Well, I mean, he's a temporary thing in a sense, but it's also what I think troubles me very much with Putin and Putin's return is that once again Russia has repeated that paradigm of moving from trying to change into not changing and basically going back to despotic system. So Putinism can last for a really long time unless Russia really decides that it needs to change and it needs to become part of the West where it belongs.
Well, I just wonder why people in Russia don't see this as a problem. Instead, they see him as is it because he's acting like Russia is once again a great power, even though it's apparent that it isn't any greater a power than it was the last time it was claiming to be a great power?
Absolutely. But, right, I mean, you know, what is the image of Russia that usually people evoke when they think about it? It's a Potemkin village, and it's yet another Potemkin village, and Russians do seem to think it's okay. I mean, it has been okay so far, and Russians do love power. Somebody who evokes power is is a person that they want to follow. But I also think it's fear of individualism. And Russia has never, ever had an individual individual agenda. It's always the state that defines our victories. And freedom is a choice, and you really have to make it, and then you have to learn it. And it didn't seem to ever happen to the Russians. They want to do it.
Isn't Medvedev pushing a plan in the Duma today to extend the presidential term from 4 years to 6 years?
Yes, he does.
That Duma is the lower house of the Russian parliament.
Right.
But the suggestion is that this is a way for Putin to come back into power, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, shoot me if I'm wrong in 6 years, but I really don't believe that Putin really would like to become. I think he would like to stay in power. I don't know if he wants to be Russian president, because the system that has been designed today is even more, I think it's more successful for him, because the presidents can change and the parliament, and he can argue, in fact, that Russia now is a parliamentary democracy, so he steps away from its usual vertical authoritarian power. So in a sense, it would be an interesting development to see how it plays out. Who will benefit from this 6 years? Because I don't think we know yet.
The day after our election, President Medvedev delivered his State of the Nation speech. Can you give us a brief summary of what he said?
Well, the major thing that was cited everywhere, and I think that was the message to, I think it was the message to Barack Obama to say, you know, change your policy towards Russia or else. And mostly they were referring to the missile shield that is going to be implemented in Poland and Czech Republic. Because Russians, as you know, were very much against it right from the beginning, and they thought it was that's when the relationship between the two men, George Bush and Vladimir Putin, started going down, because Putin really felt it was a betrayal of Bush to implement something that he felt was completely unnecessary for the United States.
Well, many scientists have said it won't work anyway, so why does it bother Putin so much?
Well, it's going back to this idea of a strong state. I mean, Russia has very little concept of soft power, and what you do to me, I'm going to do to you. It's zero-sum game, zero-sum mentality, because Russia is really, and the pendulum thing, I mean, it goes from one extreme to another. If you do that to me, I'm going to do the same to you. They really don't moderate, and I think that's something that hopefully one day Russia will learn to decipher messages rather than to react to them the way they appear.
Has Senator Obama made any statements on whether he might continue to employ President Bush's plan for a missile shield?
Well, didn't he say that that the United States needs more testing? And I think when he had, he had a conversation with Dmitry Medvedev, the Russian president, and it did seem to go well. And President-elect Obama didn't promise that yes, we did indeed do it, but we'll continue a conversation. Although we do know that the Polish president, in reaction to that, said, "Oh, but I was promised that it's going to be there." So once again, I think there's so much expectation for President-elect Obama, and I think the whole world waits for him to solve all the problems that the Bush administration created, and I think the Russians do the same.
In fact, Medvedev recently said in an interview that he hopes to have a better relationship with President Obama when he's president.
Absolutely.
Than he had with the Bush administration, and I'm assuming that when he speaks that Putin is also speaking, at least on that kind of thing.
I think so. I think so. I think, or at least Putin allows him to say that, because in some ways for Putin, the bad relationship and Bush's existence was very convenient, because they could argue zero sum in a much easier way, while with President-elect Obama or President Obama, it would be much harder, because I do hope that America itself would become a more democratic country. So it would be hard to say, oh, we're not going to do XYZ because Dick Cheney is not a beacon of democracy.
Is Dick Cheney Putin? Oh, well, that's a whole other question. Nina Krusheva she teaches international affairs at the New School and is the author of an article in the fall 2008 World Policy Journal called Russia's Rotting Empire. We have to talk a bit about Ukraine, because that seems to really have upset Putin. Why? Isn't Ukraine going through its own shaky political situation right now?
It does.
With a serious power struggle?
Yes, it does. I'm a very big fan of Ukraine. In fact, in this article, I sort of predict Russian future as something that will work for Russia if it joins Ukraine in its stride for European Union and being really Western country that Ukraine tries to do. Yes, they do have a power struggle. It's not perfect. After all, they were part of the Russian Empire, so they do have a little bit of the same mentality as we the Russians do. But it actually, unlike many other analysts, I don't think it's a huge trouble because it's a struggle. There is a conversation. There is a debate going on. The press is not prosecuted. You have freedom to express yourself. There are NGOs that work on very important social issues. So it's a process of democratization, something that President Putin and President Medvedev, at least for now, continues that was completely stopped in Russia, saying, well, we're a great country. We don't need it anymore.
Would it be different if Ukraine hadn't made a bid to join the EU?
No, I don't think so. I think they really tried in 2004, as you remember, Russians really tried to change the elections and instill their own candidate Yanukovych. Exactly, and rig the elections. And it seemed that they learned the lesson. I mean, I'm using this term loosely. They stopped doing it through power, but they're using oil and gas to do that. And it seems. Like not too much of a development, but nonetheless, at least they're not doing it with guns, as far as I'm concerned.
Because oil and gas prices are a little depressed right now, does that give Russia a little less clout?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and I really hope that this would be Ukraine's window opportunity to really make the choices it wants to make.
Earlier this year, as I said before, you published a book called "Imagining Nabokov," in which you said that the West should learn about Russia by reading Nabokov. Now, I was surprised because Nabokov lived most of his life outside of Russia. I would have thought that the West could learn a lot more about Russia if it's a constant by reading Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or Chekhov or Solzhenitsyn.
Oh, absolutely. But I think what I was I don't remember exactly that quote, but I think what I was more talking about is that Russia should learn how to be Western from reading Nabokov, precisely because Nabokov did live most of his life outside of Russia, and he learned Western values and how to live in a Western world firsthand. But he was also very much of a Russian descent. In fact, half of his life he did write in Russian until 1940. So his body of work could be divided into Russian and Western. But my main argument, Russians, as I said, Russia doesn't change. And politically, it does go from less despot to a more despot. So in somewhat it is a retarded political system. But Russians are great artistically. So Solzhenitsyn taught us about dissidentship more than anything else. And I thought that Nabokov should teach Westernism the same way.
Well, it's interesting that during the Soviet era, some great literature came out of the Soviet Union, I guess I could say Russia, partly some people say because artists were forced to be more subtle, to provide a lot of subtext. Well, we're starting to see the imposition of censorship once again in the country. In fact, there's very little opposition media.
It is very little opposition media. There is some oppositional literature. I mean, because censorship is great for art, because how else would you're going to express yourself if you cannot express yourself any other way? You have to paint. You have to write great books. But I think the danger of Putinism, or what the system that was created, was not an absolute oppression. So it had a little bit of a way out. There was the internet. I mean, also instances of modernity. So in this way, Putinism could be very dangerous for a really long time, because unlike Stalinism, that after a while you just cannot be suffocated, you have to scream. But Putinism, it gives you a little bit of a way out. You can travel. So in a sense, it can be even more dangerous than Stalinism. And as for literature today, I think for now it's more visual art that is protesting.
It's almost like the Tsarist time, where people could leave but at the same time, they could, like Dostoevsky, could also be sent off to Siberia for saying the wrong thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it does sort of this, the softness of this despotic system is dangerous.
Now, you must have left when you were fairly young because your English is so, you know, close to perfect.
Thank you.
How old were you when you came here?
Well, I first of all, I didn't leave. I just came here for graduate school. I went to graduate school in 91.
Did you speak English this well even
then? No, it was I write in English. I love writing in English. It's a very disciplined language. It's part of my, like with Nabokov, I'm not comparing us directly, but with Nabokov, it's learning how to be Western, how to discipline your thoughts, how to express yourself coherently and concisely.
It is interesting that Conrad and Nabokov are among the greatest stylists in the English language, and this wasn't their first or even second language.
Absolutely, because I think that English allows you to do things that other languages can't. No, I spoke some English, but you know, it's Princeton.
Do people immediately make certain assumptions about you when they see your name?
No, not really. I mean, I think my greatest achievement in America is anonymity. And I do teach at the New School. And as you know, the New School has this great tradition of saving the world. So for them, for my students, Russia and Russian problems are more that the elites are fighting. There's all the Cold War. Now they're real struggle and they're real wars. So that's why I enjoy being there, because I feel very much part of the world there.
Well, it is interesting that words like communist are still being used these days. I just received an email from somebody claiming that Barack Obama is a communist.
That was remarkable.
But, okay, he isn't a communist. But still, all these years after the fall of communism, it still is part of our dialogue in this country. Do you think Americans are as confused about things as the Russians obviously are?
I don't think so. I think it's, I mean, communism is a great propaganda tool. You really, you need to have a good enemy. And I think one of the reasons that McCain campaign failed is that they used the wrong enemy, because they really invested a lot into the former Cold War rhetoric that really they thought wouldn't require thinking. People really didn't care, and I think that failed for them. So it's not communism. Obama is not communist. Take my word for it.
Just one more thing before you go. What are your thoughts about the theory that there's something in the national psyche of the Russian people that favors a strongman type of ruler?
I agree with that. I do happen to agree that it is indeed part of the national psyche.
Why Russia, not any other countries that also had strong kings over their history?
Oh, absolutely. It's a great question. Well, I mean, I don't have much time, so let me say very quickly. It's a frontier country. It's on the outskirts of the world, and it's an imitation culture. And so it defines itself through what somebody else is not. And therefore, it really needs to stay together. I mean, this society of we that Russia always tries to talk about is the society of we, that we all are together against some unknown enemy that is going to come from the steppes or from the woods and something. And I think it still continues. And that's why this whole Mother Russia, father of the nation, is there to protect us.
We even see it in Ivan the Terrible, at least the movie of
Absolutely.
Ivan the Terrible.
In Stalin. I mean, Stalin was that great father of the nation. Putin is called father of the nation.
Nina Khrushcheva is a teacher of international affairs at the New School, author of an article in the fall 2008 World Policy Journal called Russia's Rotting Empire, also of Imagining Nabokov, which was published earlier this year by the Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.